From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Mike, all of the weapons that were banned for import today can be manufactured domestically. In terms of guns on the street, what practical difference was made this morning?
President Clinton unveils his anti-foreign assault gun initiative. We'll look at what its real effects will be on the streets of the United States. And as Madeleine Albright wraps up a two-day Caribbean meeting in Trinidad, we'll take a look at drugs and free trade.
Trinidad and Tobago has, in absolute terms, the second highest U.S. direct foreign investment in the hemisphere.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The financial world was rocked yesterday by its biggest deal ever, Travelers Group Incorporated and Citicorp's plan to combine in a nearly $83 billion merger. The merger, double the previous record, stunned Wall Street and quickly raised concerns from consumer groups, bank experts, and lawmakers because it would challenge Depression-era laws barring banks, securities, and insurance firms from getting into one another's businesses. Citibank is the nation's second largest bank, and Travelers is the parent of Salomon Smith Barney. Citigroup Inc., as the merged company would be called, would have 100 million customers in 100 countries. Strategically, the combination would allow Travelers to sell its insurance and brokerage services to Citicorp's 60 million credit card customers, while Citicorp would be able to boost its asset management and securities brokerage business around the world. The United States has been accused of unfair, arbitrary, and racist use of the death penalty by a United Nations special investigator in a report at a meeting of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights in Geneva. Overriding American objections, the commission voted last week for the second year in a row to call for a worldwide moratorium on executions. The author of the United Nations report, Bakary Wale Ndiaye, a lawyer from Senegal, wrote that race, ethnic origin, and economic status appear to be key determinants of who will and who will not receive a sentence of death in the United States. The United States, Iran, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen are the only countries where teens under the age of 18 can be executed, the report said, adding that this violates international law. Executing mentally handicapped defendants, a practice allowed in 28 of the 38 American states that have capital punishment, is a breach of international standards. This, again, according to the report. Ndiaye made a visit to the United States in September. He met with federal officials in New York, Florida, Texas, and California, and went on visits to death rows. This news from Minnesota, rebuffed by the U.S. Supreme Court, the tobacco industry has been forced to turn over 200,000 pages of potentially damaging internal documents, a move foes say could have a ripple effect in lawsuits across the country. Michael Ceresi, the lead attorney for the state and Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, said as many as 20 attorneys could work nonstop to review the 39,000 documents. The state and the insurance company are suing cigarette makers to recover $1.77 billion they say was spent treating smoking-related illnesses. They also are seeking punitive damages. The military is discharging two-thirds more gay and lesbian troops today than when the Clinton administration adopted its Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, this according to a Defense Department report to be issued later this month. A total of 997 military personnel were discharged for homosexuality last year, the report says, compared with 597 in 94, the first full year that the policy was in effect. Gay rights advocates see those figures as evidence for their contention that gay men and lesbians are being outed and ousted in ever larger numbers. They say that gay and lesbian personnel are still subject to interrogation and harassment by commanders. Burma's military government will not grant the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations permission to visit as long as its leaders are barred from entering the United States. Bill Richardson had hoped to visit Burma as part of a swing through South Asia beginning on Saturday that includes Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. In October 1996, President Clinton issued an executive order barring members of the military government and their families from visiting the United States. The Bolivian government threatened yesterday to impose a state of siege unless labor leaders and cabinet members negotiated an end to a strike that has sparked 4 days of violent protests in the capital and a major cocaine-producing region. The protests are part of an open-ended strike called last Wednesday by the Bolivian Workers' Confederation to demand, among other things, wage hikes and the end of a coca eradication program. At least 300,000 people in the Chapare depend on coca leaf cultivation for their livelihood. And more than 30 years after exchanging his priest collar for a gun, the leader of Colombia's second largest rebel group has died. This according to another guerrilla leader, Manuel Perez, a native of Spain who for decades led the National Liberation Army, or ELN, died February 14th at a jungle hideout. Perez was defrocked after he took up arms, but still went by the name Father Perez. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today we're going to take a look at President Clinton's assault ban, well, we should say foreign assault weapons ban. President Clinton yesterday announced a ban on importing nearly 60 types of assault weapons that the White House says will stop an estimated 1.5 million semi-automatic rifles like Uzis and AK-47s from entering the United States. The decision makes permanent a November ban on assault weapons that have been modified to permit their import for sport use. But the National Rifle Association says they will seek to overturn the executive order in Congress. We're joined now by two people to respond to the Clinton initiative. Josh Sugarman is the executive director of the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C. We're also joined by Tina Johnstone, who is a gun control activist whose husband was a murder victim in San Francisco 5 years ago. She's planning a silent march in Washington on May 2nd. Josh Sugarman, before we talk about the substance of the initiative, I thought it would be interesting to play for our listeners an interaction that Mike McCurry, the press spokesperson for President Clinton, had with reporters yesterday at the White House.
Mike, all of the weapons that were banned for import today can be manufactured domestically. In terms of guns on the street, what practical difference was made this morning?
Well, I believe your background briefer gave you a good answer to that. I think that there is surely, based on the recommendations of the law enforcement communities, they have to deal with gun violence in the streets. Felt strongly that this was a warranted step, and they're the ones who are in the best position to know exactly what kind of violence and what kind of human tragedy has been the result of some of these weapons.
Well, it doesn't seem to take a single weapon off the street.
Well, you had an expert here, and I can't add to what he said. I can't do any better than he did. Yeah,
well,
Connie.
Can I just follow up, Mike? Why not ban domestic manufacturers from manufacturing the same thing that imported manufacturers?
Well, the scope of the law that allowed us to issue this report and take this action is defined pretty clearly by Congress, and we acted within the scope of that law.
If there was a car that was manufactured both in the U.S. and abroad that was killing people, you wouldn't merely ban the importation of the car. You ban the whole thing. It doesn't seem to make much sense to ban imports when the same thing can be built here. I mean, can you explain how that makes sense?
The sporting purposes test that was set forth in the law only applies to the importation of firearms. The Secretary does not have authority to stop the domestic production of weapons that do not meet the sporting purposes test. So it's within the nature of the law that the President acted under.
Right, which is why I asked originally, one would presume then that the administration would be going to Congress and saying, you've got to stop this domestically,
well,
too.
Well, I'll check and see if that's a discussion that's under consideration. Yeah.
Mike McCurry, yesterday, press spokesperson for President Clinton, responding to reporters' questions at the White House about the initiative that President Clinton unveiled yesterday. Josh Sugarman of the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C., can you explain what this initiative is about?
Sure. I mean, Ashley McCurry is correct. Under the 1968 Gun Control Act, the Department of the Treasury is granted far broader jurisdiction as to what comes into the country under the sporting purposes test. What ATF did yesterday was they essentially reviewed the test and said that these weapons cannot come in. domestically produced assault weapons and firearms essentially are unregulated. And the only law governing assault weapons in America is the 1994 Crime Bill. Unfortunately, since 1994, what we've seen is that the industry has worked its way around the limited definition contained in that measure. So in the same way that you saw foreign manufacturers modifying their weapons, taking off some of the bells and whistles that were identified in the original ATF directive in 1989 for foreign weapons, that's also happened on the domestic front. For example, right now, Colt, which makes an assault rifle, the AR-15, that weapon is banned under the domestic law, but in fact they've made slight modifications. It's back out on the street. It has a new name. I believe it's the Sporter. At the same time, other companies have put out similar weapons. One has a gun called the PCR, which stands for the politically correct rifle. So I think really if you have to go at this problem, if you want to really ban assault weapons, we have to revisit the 1994 domestic assault weapons ban.
Why the distinction? Why is President Clinton talking about foreign assault weapons and not domestic?
Well, I think it's two things. One is that since the Bush administration tried to ban foreign assault weapons back in the late 1980s, you've seen a tremendous growth and continued import of these modified weapons. One of the things that I think most people don't recognize is that throughout the 1990s, these modified assault weapons were coming into the United States. It's only when the Uzi was going to come back in that public attention focused on it. The reason they're focusing on this is because they can do this without action of Congress. ATF can review the import criteria modified to keep out this class of weapons. One of our concerns is that whereas the announcement yesterday may have addressed today's problem, this current batch of weapons, it may not fully take into account future modifications the industry might make to get them back into the country.
We're also joined by Tina Johnstone, and she wrote a piece in the Ladies' Home Journal that's just come out in the March issue called I'm Fighting the War Against Guns. It begins, even the most jaded Washington politician was surely moved by the spectacle, ringing the Capitol reflecting pool on a clear September morning where nearly 40,000 pairs of shoes sorted neatly into groups representing all 50 states. As passersby learned, these shoes were represented the number of Americans killed by guns in a single year. Families of shooting victims told the tragic stories of how their loved ones came to be included in that total and how the empty shoes, many of which had belonged to the victims, bore silent witness to their memories. Tina Johnstone, your husband was the victim of an attack. He is a murder victim killed 5 years ago in San Francisco. Can you tell us where that has led you and how you respond to President Clinton's initiative?
Yes. I actually never say my husband was murdered. I always say my husband was shot and killed. I do believe that he would be alive had the child not had a gun available to him. And that therein lies my activism, that I have done nothing but talk about gun violence prevention and the role of guns and how it is an unregulated industry in our country and how we need to change that since David has died.
Do you think that President Clinton's initiative to go after foreign assault weapons is a step in the right direction?
We're always grateful for any initiative, but it's clearly not enough. We have a long way to go, and once we take care of assault weapons, we have handguns. And the next silent march this spring is going to be not in Washington in front of Congress, but in front of handgun manufacturers. We want the public to see the role that handgun manufacturers play in this epidemic of gun violence.
Can you name some names, Tina Johnstone? Can you talk about some of the corporations where you'll be bringing those shoes of victims?
One will be Smith & Wesson in Springfield, Massachusetts. It is the largest handgun manufacturer in the world. We are the biggest manufacturer of handguns in our country, in the world. And Smith & Wesson's are the handgun most often recovered in crime in a number of communities. We are also demonstrating in front of the Ring of Fire manufacturers in Southern California.
Who are the Ring of Fire manufacturers?
They are the manufacturers of what is called a Saturday Night Special. They're very concealable, they're very lightweight, and they're very inexpensive.
What have been the corporation's response to your massive organizing efforts, you and other people around the country, particularly families of those who've been killed by guns?
We haven't had any response from them yet. Their responses are coming with to the other initiatives that are already out there, like the safety locks, and we are much more concerned about what the public's response will be, and hopefully we can educate the public.
Now, the National Rifle Association, one of their slogans is, guns don't kill people, people do. Tina Johnstone, what's your response to that?
My response is, people with guns kill people.
We're talking about President Clinton's initiative yesterday to ban some foreign assault weapons. Can you tell us, Josh Sugarman, what the lobbying scene is like in Washington, D.C. around these issues?
Well, I think right now in the wake of this, the NRA has announced that they're going to try and overturn this somehow, you know, through the through Congress. But I think right now the lobbying situation is virtually a stalemate. And what we have to look at is the fact that you do have a Republican-controlled House that is very pro-gun. And I think one of the unfortunate things from those of us in the gun control movement, some of us, is that we've taken this political reality and sort of tempered our own response. You know, say, look, following Jonesboro, when you saw a response talking about how if only these guns had trigger locks or something like that. And the reality is what Jonesboro brings home, and the problem with America, its firearms, death and injuries, it's guns. And that we have to start looking at the problem of guns in America. We've talked about banning certain categories of firearms, like handguns, like a real assault weapons ban. And I think, you know, that's one of the shifts you're going to start seeing in this debate, a more open discussion, especially in the wake of the, you know, other countries, England, Australia, where they have a mask, where they have a very natural reaction. They look to the guns as opposed to looking at, say, pictures of guns on television and blaming them for it.
Your center, the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C., has come out with a number of reports, one of them called Young Guns.
Right. We put out a document set following the Jonesboro massacre because one of the things that we've been looking at is the marketing of guns to kids by the gun industry, by the NRA and other lobbying associations like the National Shooting Sports Foundation. And one of the things we found is that, you know, if you compare it to the tobacco debate and the tobacco industry, where they're very secretive and we're finding these documents coming out saying, we want to market to kids, here's how we're going to do it. We have to hit them before they get out of their teens, or we're going to lose them. And these come out, they're published in the Washington Post, New York Times, and people are shocked. What strikes us is that when you read the gun industry publications, you read the NRA's publications, they say the exact same thing about kids and guns, but they say it publicly. And one of our concerns is the fact that if you accept the NRA's vision and the gun industry's vision of a youth gun culture, then things like Jonesboro are unfortunately inevitable.
We're going to break for our stations to identify themselves in just a minute, but I wanted to give our listeners a chance to write down some numbers before I ask you the last question. Can you tell us where people can go to get the reports that the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C. has put out? Josh Sugarman.
Yes, there are two ways. One is they can visit our website to get the press releases and sometimes the actual reports themselves or parts of them, which is www.vpc.org. Otherwise, they can contact the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and our number is 202-822-8200.
That's 202-822-8200. and Tina Johnstone. For people who are interested in participating in the marches that you have organized around the country on May 2nd, where can they call?
They can call this phone number, and that is 516-247-9109. I'm sorry, 9101. That is a toll call, but it will afford you your local state coordinator. We also have a website, and that is www.silentmarchoneword.org.
That's 516-247-9101. When I come back, I want to ask you each, if you were president of the United States, what would you do about guns in America? You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we finish up our discussion with Josh Sugarman, the executive director of the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and Tina Johnstone, whose husband was shot and killed 5 years ago in San Francisco. She has become a staunch gun control activist, leading marches both in Washington, D.C. this past May with a novel image that is now spreading around the country and is the picture of thousands of shoes being laid out, sort of like the AIDS quilt, shoes of murder victims. And now those shoes are going to be taken to weapons manufacturers around the country this May. Well, Josh Sugarman, if you were president of the United States, what do you think is the single most important thing to do about guns in this country?
Well, I think in two words for an easy answer, it's ban handguns. In a broader thing is actually what we need to do is put in place a comprehensive regulatory framework that treats firearms and firearm manufacturers and holds them to the same standards as other consumer products. Basically, right now, the gun industry is the only unregulated industry in America, and we believe that you should hold the industry and the products they manufacture to the same health and safety standards. Basically, does the harm outweigh the good of the product? If it does outweigh the good, you modify the product to make it safe, or you take it off the market. We would argue that if you apply that standard, the same standard we apply to toasters, teddy bears, automobiles, if you apply that to firearms, you are talking about banning handguns, banning assault weapons, limiting new technology, and the guns that would remain on the market, which would be the vast majority, your traditional hunting and shooting rifles, would actually be safer for quote-unquote gun consumers.
Do you think the NRA, the National Rifle Association, is getting more or less powerful?
I think the NRA is getting less powerful. I think what we're finding is that, you know, the NRA views the gun control battle as a literal war. It will accept nothing less than their destruction as proof of their having lost. I think what you're finding is the NRA is in this bind in that when they don't come out as hardline, their activists view them as soft. And when they do try and come out as hardline, I think they scare away not only traditional gun owners, but also the American public. I mean, the NRA today, they're in financial trouble. They're grasping at straws. If you look at the agenda on the federal level, they have a Republican Congress, but they recognize there's not a pro-gun agenda anymore. It's a defensive agenda. They've devolved down to the states. And I think if you look at any other movement, you know, right now we're in a very critical time in the gun debate in America. The NRA is weakening. We forced the gun industry from the shadows into the debate. And I think we're right on the verge of a real debate over guns in America. And I think the NRA will become less and less of a player as you see the involvement and the engagement of organizations beyond the traditional gun control suspects, public health organizations, youth organizations, medical associations. They're starting to step into the breach and saying that we have to start looking at guns in America. We start doing something about it.
And Tina, if you were President Johnstone?
I would vote for Josh Sugarman to be president. I wholeheartedly agree, and I think our country and our elected officials need to look at Europe and how they have just a minuscule number of homicides and suicides compared to our country, and the difference is the guns that are available to our people.
Well, perhaps something good can come out of Jonesboro. We'll see. Tina Johnstone and Josh Sugarman, I want to thank you for joining us. Again, their numbers, Tina Johnstone, who is helping to organize marches around the country on May 2nd at arms manufacturers around the country. That number is 516-247-9101. That's 516-247-9101. Website www.silentmarch.org. And Josh Sugarman's Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C. The website is vpc.org. Phone number 202-822-8200. Thank you very much for joining us. Up next, we take a look at Trinidad Tobago, where the Secretary of State has just left.
Once upon a time, this country was sweet. People could align freely on the street. Where there was north or south, you could always walk without the fear of molestation and intimidation.
Secretary of State Madeleine Albright wrapped up yesterday a two-day trip to Trinidad and Tobago, where she attended the 15-Nation Caribbean Community, or CARICOM, meeting. As expected, trade and drug issues dominated the conference. Many Caribbean countries gathered this past week criticized Washington for preaching free trade while refusing to drop trade barriers to Caribbean countries. But Madeleine Albright told the meeting that the Clinton administration would fight to win CARICOM trade benefits, benefits that Clinton had promised at a U.S.-Caribbean summit meeting last May. The decision to hold the CARICOM meeting in Trinidad was no accident. Composed of two islands located just off the northeastern corner of South America, Trinidad and Tobago have emerged as one of the most important countries in the Western Hemisphere. U.S. companies have been pouring billions of dollars into Trinidad, more than even Mexico, according to some analysts. And the government of Prime Minister Bastio Pandey was the first Caribbean government to sign a controversial agreement allowing the U.S. military to pursue alleged drug traffickers into its territorial airspace and waters. The 96 agreement, known as the Shiprider Agreement, led to severe criticism from neighboring islands, which accused Trinidad of sacrificing its sovereignty. But since then, other Caribbean countries have signed the Shiprider Agreement. Today on Democracy Now!, we're going to take a special look at Trinidad and the Caribbean. Democracy Now! Producer Dan Coughlin got a chance to travel to Trinidad recently and spoke with David Abdullah, the Chief Education and Research Officer of the Oil Workers Trade Union, one of the oldest and most important trade unions in the Caribbean. Over lunch at a Chinese restaurant in central Trinidad, Dan Coughlin asked David Abdullah about how free trade issues are playing out in Trinidad and the Caribbean.
There are several different currents. At official level, the government is very much in support and in favor of free trade and trade liberalization. In fact, this government and previous governments have been embarked on a process of trade liberalization. And this process has been driven partly by some conditionality from the Inter-American Development Bank, the IDB, but also on the basis of the philosophy of the governments themselves. And so that we are participating in the whole process of the free trade area of the Americas. Within Trinidad and Tobago, the local manufacturing sector, which itself is largely dependent on imported raw materials and inputs, has been of the view that it can compete. Trinidad and Tobago is the largest exporter in the CARICOM area, the Caribbean Community, economic area by far. Trinidad and Tobago, I think, has something like 70%+ of CARICOM trade at the moment. And the Trinidad and Tobago manufacturers have been using that as a platform to get into other areas, Dominican Republic, some of the South American countries and so on, some cases United States, some European countries. And so they feel that they could take on free trade. I disagree with them, but that's what they think. So there is a very strong impetus in Trinidad and Tobago, wrongly placed, I believe, but there's a strong impetus towards free trade. And Trinidad and Tobago has also, at an earlier period, sought to be part of NAFTA. In other words, we had tried to get on this mystical or mythical list, short list of countries that were NAFTA ready. And we were told that after Chile, we were going to be next or some such thing like that. So that in terms of the other requirements of financial deregulation and liberalization of the financial sector, the deregulation and liberalization of the foreign exchange regime and the currency and so on. So all of these things were put in place as preconditions for entry to NAFTA. And therefore, it is the view of Trinidad and Tobago that we are going to be ready for the free trade area of the Americas when it comes into being in the year 2005. To that extent, therefore, Trinidad and Tobago has a different position in those official circles to our CARICOM partners, in that most of the countries of the Eastern Caribbean are not enamored of the free trade. They don't have a manufacturing base. They have been badly affected by the United States' policy in the World Trade Organization on the question of bananas and so on. And they are not keen on the free trade area of the Americas. So that within CARICOM, you have a range of positions. And therefore, CARICOM has to sort itself out in terms of what its negotiating position is going to be in the whole process of the free trade area of the Americas. The thing is that the process has begun, and there are many committees dealing with specific areas of negotiation involving all the countries of the region. And these committees, technical committees, are going to lay down the ground rules and the framework for the free trade area, and they're going to have that ready. And some of them have their agreements that have already been made. Most people don't know that. There are agreements that have already been made, which will then have to be formally ratified by a treaty when it comes into being in 5 years or so. There is a concern here, of course, as to whether President Clinton is going to have his way. Already he lost the fast track in terms of trade negotiations. Will he not be able to get Congress to go along with the FTA, Free Trade Area of the Americas? That is a concern. And therefore, to it raises for us several things. In the minds of some people, it is that we should lobby Congress to agree with Clinton for fast track and for free trade. In the minds of some others of us, it says to us, if the U.S. is ambivalent about the free trade process, why are we being so gung-ho on free trade? And we may then end up in a situation where we have liberalized our regime more than as required by the World Trade Organization and the agreement of Uruguay Round of GATT. We have liberalized faster than that and further than that, and then put ourselves in a position of extreme disadvantage to powerful economies like the U.S. or Europe, which have not liberalized as fast. And therefore, all that we have done is to open our markets to the penetration by the transnationals.
Trinidad and Tobago is an important oil producer in the hemisphere. It produces more than 100,000 barrels per day. Has there been pressure related to the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas on privatization of the oil industry?
Well, the oil industry, let me just back up. We produce about 120,000, 130,000 barrels of oil a day, which is large for the Caribbean, if you exclude Venezuela and Colombia, Mexico, and so on. We are very small on the international scale. However, we have historically been strategically located, and that has been the significance of Trinidad and Tobago. Now, we lost that strategic importance in terms of oil in the 1970s, when the U.S. shifted its oil policy in relation to the oil shocks of 73, the OPEC oil shocks of 73, when refining capacity was expanded in the U.S. So that it would reduce their dependence on external oil. And also the demand for oil was also substantially curtailed by way of more efficient motor vehicles, more efficient means of heating and insulating buildings and homes and so on. Now, all of that meant that Trinidad lost its significance as an oil producer. We have now become primarily a producer of natural gas. We have very large deposits of gas relative to oil and relative to some other countries as well. And we have been a substantial producer of gas for some time. So that has meant that there's a whole infrastructure in place to go downstream of the natural gas. So that today Trinidad and Tobago is the largest exporter of ammonia in the world and the largest exporter of methanol in the world. We have also become a significant steel producer, though we produce no iron ore. So we have one steel mill, which was originally state-owned, is now owned by an Indian transnational company, ISPAT. And we have two steel, a second one was built called Nucor, built by a small independent steel producer in the States. And a third steel mill is now being built now by Cliffs, I think Cliffs and Associates. ISPAT is expanding its steel mill, and Nucor plans to expand its steel mill. So very soon we will have quite a significant steel production here. And there are two aluminium smelters being planned for construction to be started in 1998-99 in Trinidad. And we are also putting down right now a LNG, liquid natural gas plant. Now, this complex of downstream activity of natural gas makes Trinidad very strategic in the methanol, ammonia, steel, and natural gas as an energy, raw energy source country. And in these areas, it is all foreign capital virtually. Trinidad and Tobago has, in absolute terms, the second highest U.S. direct foreign investment in the hemisphere, I think, after Brazil. And we have the highest per capita by far direct foreign investment in the hemisphere. And we're talking about substantial amounts of money here. We're talking about a LNG plant being built by Amoco, Cabot Lodge, and a Spanish company. $1 billion, single plant. Methanol plants being put down at $300 million apiece. Ammonia plants at $400 million apiece. Steel mills at $200 to $400 million apiece. Aluminium smelters at $1 billion apiece. These are substantial capital investments in the country, long-term capital investments in the country. But the whole process of economic liberalization, of privatization and so on, has been substantially gone through.
What has been the reaction of multinationals to the oil workers' trade union?
There have been mixed reactions. They have had to deal with us from the early days. The oil workers' union was formed in 1937, so we are more than 60 years old now. And from then, there were transnationals here. Shell came into Trinidad in 1908, so we dealt with Shell from our very formation. And they had to deal with us. They had no choice but to deal with us. And so they would have entered into collective bargaining arrangements, hostile at many times, confrontational, but they had to deal with us. Texaco entered Trinidad in 1956 when they bought over a then British company, and they also had to deal with us. Again, hostile, confrontational, but they had no choice but to deal with us. British Petroleum was here in the 50s and the 60s, and they had to deal with us as well. They are now out. Amoco, however, which came in later, has been able to avoid dealing with us, though we have tried to unionize the workers. And in fact, right now, we have had a claim pending before the Recognition Board, which is the body, statutory body, which gives unions official certification and recognition as a majority recognized union in our workplace. We have had a claim for something like 6 years now before the board, clearly, in my view, Amoco has been able to use its power in the country to prevent the recognition board from recognizing us as a union. This is not the first time that we have made a claim. We made a claim in the 80s, and we were stymied then also, and so on. So Amoco has had a conscious policy of not wishing to be unionized. Amoco has had a different structure as well. Because they came more recently as an oil producer and they were operating offshore only, they have had a small core workforce, large number of contractor employees. Now, what has now happened is that everybody else has followed that pattern. And that's one of the major issues. It's much more difficult to unionize contractor workers or casual workers, temporary workers, part-time workers. And that right now, like for most unions all over the world, is a major challenge of the reorganization of the workplace.
David Abdullah, Chief Education and Research Officer of the Oil Workers Trade Union, one of the oldest and most important trade unions in the Caribbean. He's speaking with Democracy Now! Producer Dan Coughlin, who just came back from a trip to Trinidad and Haiti, both places that U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has just returned from. We're going to continue with that conversation, and then Dan will speak with another person from Trinidad about women in Trinidad and the Caribbean. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
What's going on in my country, Lord? Tell me what is wrong, I want to know. Hijackers, kidnappers, and multiple murderers. Trinidad and Tobago, long ago was never, never so. Because the burglarizers, the peeping toms and mischief makers were all behind bars. Now the murder rate gone up, I ain't telling lies. Like the crime wouldn't stop, don't care how we try. The realization is that the
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we go back to the conversation with Democracy Now! Producer Dan Coughlin talking to David Abdullah, Chief Education and Research Officer of the Oil Workers Trade Union, following up on U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's visit to Trinidad, where she enlisted 15 Caribbean nations to build a web of law and enforcement to deter drug smugglers.
What is the shipwrighter agreement that Trinidad signed with the United States, and why has that been causing such a uproar throughout the Caribbean?
Essentially, the U.S. Has seen the Caribbean as the point at which it would fight the drug battle, in addition to fighting it at the point of production. It fights it less within the boundaries of the U.S., so that the U.S. view is that we are an extension of the borders of the U.S. This is not just in terms of drugs. This has been the political policy since the days of the Monroe Doctrine. Yes. And in reality, so we're talking about the 1890s now, yes, 100 years. Essentially, therefore, our concern is that the war on drugs will give the U.S. certain space within the Caribbean to operate militarily in a way that they haven't over the last 20 or so years of our political independence, where sovereignty was recognized and we then had the sovereign responsibility and right to deal with our military and security interests. But the U.S. policy now is that U.S. security interests mean that the Caribbean is part of the U.S. Therefore, the U.S. proposed these what are called maritime cooperation agreements, which have become popularly known as shipwrighter agreements, because they provide for the U.S. naval vessels and aircraft to operate in Caribbean sea, land, and airspace, preferably with a ship rider, a rider who is a member of the security forces from our country, to be on that vessel. Or if not practical or possible, then without that ship rider being on board. And to operate within our land, sea, and airspace, not only in fast pursuit of a vessel, either air vessel or a ship, a sea vessel, that is suspected of carrying narcotics, but also, in the case of the Trinidad and Tobago Ship Rider Agreement, to actually patrol the waters on the search for illegal activity and so on. And it provides for the American military forces to have power of detention and arrest, detention, I suppose, pending the handing over to the Trinidad and Tobago authorities for the formal processing and charging and so on, if it takes place within our territorial limits. Now, Trinidad and Tobago very quietly, in terms of the international scene, signed this agreement. In fact, it was very significant that the then Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, himself came to Trinidad to sign a series of three or four treaties, including this Maritime Cooperation Treaty and a new extradition treaty, and there were one or two other drug cooperation treaties. I think there were three or four in all that were signed. Highly unusual for a Secretary of State to come to a relatively small Caribbean country to sign an agreement such as this. But I think it signaled the fact that Trinidad and Tobago is seen to be the good boy in the region insofar as not only cooperation in drugs, but also on matters of economic and trade and so on and so on. And that Trinidad and Tobago being a key country within the CARICOM, that perhaps Trinidad and Tobago would be able to influence some of the other countries of the Caribbean to follow suit and so on. Trinidad and Tobago, I think perhaps the government signed it for various reasons, partly because of the massive U.S. investment either taking place or pending, and therefore it felt that this was one means of, yes, demonstrating that we are very cooperative, we are very a good location for foreign investment, we have very good relations with the United States, and so on and so on and so on. And I think that was one of the factors that influenced the government to sign it. Another factor, obviously, is the fact that Trinidad and Tobago is a major transshipment point for drugs, cocaine, coming out of South America because of our proximity to South America. We are just 8 miles away from Venezuela at our nearest point. And we have been a transshipment point for some time. And there clearly needs to be some point of cooperation. But I think that the nature of the ship rider went way too far, and we have ceded our sovereignty and so on. And what ought to have happened is that CARICOM collectively ought to have negotiated a maritime cooperation agreement with the United States, so that we would have had a stronger negotiating position. We would have strengthened the sense of CARICOM cooperation, so that we would have, because there is no such cooperation between, say, Trinidad and Tobago and the other Caribbean countries. So we have given the U.S. Authority and so on that we haven't given our CARICOM neighbors, which to me is quite ridiculous. And we could have had a much stronger CARICOM multi-territorial force, perhaps with support of funding from the U.S. and whoever else, that could have done our own interdiction within the region rather than have it been done by the United States itself, because it's a thin edge of a wedge which will enable the U.S. not only to deal with drugs, but any kind of counterinsurgency, right? And that falls into other kinds of geopolitical and strategic considerations that the U.S. may have.
David Abdullah, the Chief Education and Research Officer of the Oil Workers Trade Union, one of the oldest and most important trade unions in the Caribbean, speaking with Democracy Now! Producer Dan Coughlin at a Chinese restaurant in central Trinidad. Well, the issue never came up at the 15-nation Caribbean community meeting yesterday in Trinidad. Violence against women has been growing markedly in the Caribbean in recent years, and nowhere more so than Trinidad. Dan Coughlin got a chance to travel to Trinidad recently and speak to Rhoda Reddick, the head of the Center for Gender and Development Studies at the University of West Indies in Trinidad. She's also the author of Women, Labor, and Politics in Trinidad and Tobago, and is active in the women's movement. He asked her about some of the key issues that the women's movement is facing in Trinidad.
Well, the women's movement in Trinidad is diverse. You know, it comprises a number of different types of women's organizations. And we try to be very open and inclusive and to work with women at different levels of different political and feminist persuasions. The issues for which we've organized have been varied. For example, there are some women who are very interested in becoming, in seeing more women in the political structures. There are some of us who are not very much interested in that. But all of us feel that we need to make women a political constituency to whom politicians are accountable. And so, for example, prior to the last election, a women's political platform was formed comprising women from different organizations as well as individual women. And we developed a kind of a platform document, which we then tried to discuss with all the political parties and try to get them to commit to these things before being elected. And it was also a basis through which we hope to monitor their activities after being elected. That was a very useful activity in bringing together groups and in actually creating that document. And in fact, the present government has been able to put some of the things that we demanded to implement some of them. For example, a national maternity leave law will be coming on stream soon, which would guarantee all women working outside the home 3 months maternity leave. And for every other year, she would be entitled to 3 months maternity leave with pay, full pay for 1 year, half pay for 1 month, half pay for 2 months, and the balance to be made up through national insurance payments. So we think that that is one of the achievements. Another thing that was on our document, which was approved, was a law to make domestic servants recognized as workers, which was not part of our legislation for many years, and apparently that legislation is presently being developed. So we found that that formation of that platform was very useful. We have been less successful in continuing to monitor after, because after the elections, many of us returned to our groups, returned to our other activities, and so on. In spite of that interest in issues, political and labor rights, etc., I think that the issue that has affected Trinidad and Tobago women most has been the issue of violence. And this has been a continuing problem, and has been probably the only issue that has been able to unite women across class, across age, across ethnicity, across color, across all the political persuasion. And the strange thing is that the more the movement grows, the more it develops, the more mechanisms we put in place, the more the violence increases. So, for example, as a result of the activities of the women's movement, we now have a sexual offenses bill passed in 1986, which brought together all former legislation on sexual offenses in one document. In 1991, we got a domestic violence bill, which I think they've all become acts now. Act which put restraining orders on men or women who were involved in domestic violence and who put forward a number of mechanisms to stop harassment and other forms of battering. In Trinidad and Tobago, there are about 7 or 8 shelters for battered women. That was a small population. We have 2 rape crisis centers, one in the north, one in the south. The Division of Women's Affairs runs a domestic violence hotline with a 1-800 line. The police have set up the community policing division has a counseling bureau that deals with issues of domestic violence. And yet, over the years, we see an escalation, not only in violence, but also in murders of women. And more recently, this last year, 1997, we saw an extreme escalation in rapes, including gang rapes, at day, at night, in church, in everywhere possible, as well as incest. So the movement is now at a kind of crossroads, reconsidering its strategies and its approaches, but also what we realize is that one of the biggest challenges facing the movement is a very strong backlash by men against what are perceived as the gains of the movement. And in fact, I don't know if you know that in the Caribbean, there's been a discourse emerging on what is called male marginalization. a discourse which argues that women in the Caribbean have been privileged and that, in fact, men are the ones who have been disadvantaged, and that this is evident in the school system where girls are outperforming boys, although this is something that's happening all over the world now. And where, for example, at the University of the West Indies, this campus, the St. Augustine campus, in the 1997 graduation ceremony, there were the males graduating were 39%, and that was the highest rate for the three campuses of the University of the West Indies. In Jamaica, it was just over 20%. So these situations are being used against women and are being used to fuel the great frustration that many men are feeling over the transformation in gender roles, the sexual division of labor, and women have been constructed as the enemy. And we see that this increase in violence, sometimes as a irrational or rational act by men against what they see as a challenge to masculinity per se, and to their individual position as men in society.
When we talk about the backlash against women, what have been some of the gains of women here in Trinidad and Tobago over the last couple of decades?
Well, I think the main gains have been in the area of education, where there's been relative equal opportunity, and women have made very good use of the education opportunities. They perform better at all levels of the education system. But then they need to, because they need higher levels of qualification to get the same jobs. And also be the way the labor market is structured, that men without educational qualifications have a much wider range of occupations, let's say manual and skilled trades, which women do not have. So for many women, the school system, the formal school system, is their only opportunity for some sort of economic stability or economic independence. We also have a tradition where women where many women do not marry, and many women feel there's a tradition of women taking care of themselves and their children. And therefore, for many women, if they feel that a relationship is unacceptable, they would want to leave. Or many women never marry in the first place. And for many men, when they see a relationship ending and they have no control over it, they decide, well, if I can't have you, no one else will, and they'll kill the woman. In some cases, kill the children, and about 60% of the cases also kill themselves. I also feel that the present era, the gender relations, the tensions and crisis in gender relations has been exacerbated by the economic circumstance, in that our country, like others, has been experiencing structural adjustment programs as determined by IMF and World Bank conditionalities, which have made the employment situation more difficult, which have made long-term stable employment less possible. And this instability in the employment situation has affected many men who, when faced with without the stability of traditional occupations, are less flexible in terms of their employment options, will not re-educate or retrain. And the frustrations that they feel from their economic situation are then projected onto women, who are usually much more flexible, who will take a lower paying job, or who will take a lower status job, or who would sometimes go to the US as an illegal domestic servant and send back money or barrels or whatever, or who would go back to school and get some additional qualification in order to equip herself for the labor market. So this flexibility and adaptability which women have in the face of adversity is seen somehow as a sense of their attempts to take over men's role, to assert themselves. And also many women are become quite disgusted with these men who cannot deal with the crisis.
Rhoda Reddick, head of the Center for Gender and Development Studies at the University of West Indies in Trinidad. She was interviewed by Democracy Now! Producer Dan Coughlin, who was recently in Trinidad. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! If you want a cassette copy of today's show, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, Jeremy Scahill, our director, Errol Maitland, our engineer, with Joe Gill in Washington. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Copies of the following program and other public radio programs are available through the Pacifica Radio Archives.
To Voices of Pacifica, where we explore the opinions and ideas of some of America's most intriguing public figures. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This program features Dr. Joan Borisenko, one of the most respected authors in the mind-body field and an expert on the feminine life cycle.
I heard almost nothing about the specific biology of women. We studied the 70-kilogram male, and it was just considered that a woman was a kind of 40-kilogram man with ovaries, and that's where it ended.
Dr. Borisenko trained as a medical scientist and a clinical psychologist. Her particular field of interest is psychoneuroimmunology, examining the psychological dimension to illness. Dr. Borisenko determined most medical studies were conducted on men's bodies because women's bodies are traditionally considered to be in a constant state of flux. She set out to understand more about women's bodies with her new book, A Woman's Book of Life, The Biology, Psychology, and Spirituality of the Feminine Life Cycle. Dr. Borisenko's talk was delivered at the Bodhi Tree Bookstore in Los Angeles, California, on January 26, 1997. She describes her studies in the area of ancient Chinese resources, particularly the seven-year cycles in the lives of women.
What I've tried to do in this book is not to elevate women above the status of men or look for things that make us in any way superior, but to find out what is it specifically that motivates women. What are our own biological and psychological cycles so that that can complement the male, both within us and within society? So I want to now talk about the four parts of the life cycle, and we'll take a look at their biology, psychology, and the way that that spirituality of interdependence and connectedness naturally grows out of it. First of all, if you look at the old women's literature, it talks about the feminine life cycle in three parts, maiden, mother, and crone. And it's actually time to update that. What I've done in looking and updating the maiden, mother, and crone is to say we need a fourth part of the life cycle, what's unnamed as midlife. And the name that I've given to the midlife woman is the guardian, for reasons that will become clear when we talk about the incredible nifty changes that occur physiologically, hormonally, and in our brains at midlife, which give rise to a kind of fierce woman and fierce wisdom that's very ready to say, The emperor has no clothes. The way that we are doing things is completely back-assed, and I'm not going to stand it anymore. And so that's why I call that stage of life the guardian. Back to the four cycles. I chose to look at seven-year cycles because that's the sacred number of almost every culture on the earth. You look at Native American cultures, 7 and 4 are the sacred numbers. You have the four directions and the fact that the moon changes every 7 days, and the holy days, like in Lakota, always fall on the moon days. That's when the Sabbath is. It's a moving day. Every year it falls on a different day of the week. And in all the way back as far as Pythagoras, rituals were always done in seven. The New and the Old Testament are filled with references to seven. In the old women's literature, there is a wonderful story about the river Kleitor in Greece, which goes around the center of the earth 7 times, and it's a river of blood, and it comes out at the city of Kleitoris. And so that's quite an image and quite a symbol. But it was felt that whenever you moved from one stage of being to the next, whenever there was a ritual or initiation, you had to be dipped in the blood of that river, and that that was what predated baptism. It was baptism in a river of blood and moon blood, menstrual blood, and that was the very first kind of calendar. So I thought to myself, well, this is true as a biologist. I know that those birthing rooms are filled on the full moon, and that 7 looked like a very good way to look at our physiology, both in terms of days within the month and years within the cycle. So within the first cycle, the maiden years, childhood and adolescence, I've looked in the Woman's Book of Life at the three cycles, 0 to 7, 7 to 14, 14 to 21. Then we have the mother years. And I'll just say parenthetically on the way that when I say mother years, I don't necessarily mean biological mothering. Only 80% of women mother biologically. And many women, for one reason or another, are either making the choice not to mother or having circumstances where they don't mother. So that number is growing. And I think that it's been difficult right up until now for people, for women who do not mother for whatever reason, who get stuck with the idea that somehow or other you cannot fully be a woman unless you mother. But we mother in many ways. I have several friends who have no children. And when we talk of mothering, one talks about having mothered her parents the whole time she grew up, of having mothered siblings, of mothering nephews, nieces, of mothering ideas, of mothering corporations, of mothering all kinds of things. And I think men can do that as